You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Hey, Justin, how you doing?
Wonderful. How are you?
Pretty good. I can't complain, though I will probably find ways to complain throughout this conversation. Anyway, before we dive in, why don't I introduce us? I am Connor Eccles, of course, the host of this weekend edition of the Non-Zero podcast, which we call Non-Zero World. You are Justin Logan, the Director of Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and an expert in all things U.S. foreign policy, particularly grand strategy. So you are going to be a very helpful guest this week as we talk about what is going on now in Yemen, a little bit of other sort of Middle East stuff. Maybe we'll get to some of the shifts that we've seen in Europe recently. I guess to start, I want to lay the groundwork a little bit. So in this past week, we've seen a pretty stark shift in the Trump administration in terms of how it's at least speaking about the Middle East, acting in the Middle East, and it's even starting to bomb in the Middle East, right? As we saw that in response to the Houthis saying that they're going to restart attacks against Israeli ships, the Trump administration made the decision to launch a pretty significant campaign of attacks against the Houthis in Yemen, aimed ostensibly in part at actually dislodging them, or at least stopping them from doing these attacks, but potentially even dislodging them from power, according to some reports. So that's been an obviously interesting development. In the American Conservative this week, you argued that this is a pretty stark contrast to the Trump administration in its early days, and particularly to Trump's inaugural address, in which he said that he wanted to be, quote, a peacemaker and a unifier. So I guess maybe the best question to start off with is why did the Trump administration launch these attacks this week?
I don't know, which is an unsatisfying answer, and I'm a bad think tanker for saying it, but it's the truth. I think that there is a real risk here that the administration will entrap itself, basically. That the nature of this campaign is that it can't win. The Saudis blasted away at the Yemen for 7 years, with the United States sort of providing targeting and munitions and a huge number of resources. It didn't work. There was a sort of unsatisfactory but functional ceasefire where the Saudis just stopped bombing Yemen. It was a huge humanitarian disaster, but politically, it didn't produce its desired end state. And I don't see any reason to think that an American air campaign is going to have any different results. The Houthis are engaged in a similarly strategically ineffectual campaign against shipping Western, let's call it shipping, through the Red Sea. They're using drones and cheap missiles, many of which come via Iran. But of course, the Israelis are not stopping. You know, the ostensible strategic end state that the Houthis seek is a stopping of the Israeli campaign in Gaza. And when the humanitarian aid stopped flowing, the Houthis said, "We're game on, right? We're going back at it here." So you have two sides really that have political end states that their military instruments are unlikely to get to produce. And so it's a real risk in the sense that, you know, if and when the Trump administration squares up to the idea that air power isn't going to make this problem go away, do they go right or do they go left? And I think it's anybody's guess which it is.
Yeah, I mean, I guess something that's been interesting here, and we talk about this in a newsletter for Non-Zero that will be up by the time this episode goes up, but it just seems so at odds with this sort of America first point of view, right? Because this is all, you know, if you look at it, it all seems to be downstream fundamentally of Israeli interests, right? Because if Trump were willing to put an end to the war in Gaza, were willing to pressure. Of course, Israel restarted its military campaign in Gaza this week. And the Houthis seem to be committed to the idea of not attacking shipping so long as there is a ceasefire in Gaza. So it seems unusual that Trump wouldn't do the thing that seems, I guess, most logical from my perspective for American interests, which is just to try to wind down that war. And I guess, you know, I won't ask you to figure out exactly why they did that, but I'm curious why they seem to be breaking with this America First idea that they are kind of pursuing pretty actively in Europe in particular, while it's in the Middle East.
Well, to me, like to follow the America First mantra all the way, right? The shipping that is transiting the Red Sea or wants to transit the Red Sea that now has to go around the Cape of Good Hope and take 2 weeks more is Europe Asia shipping, right? It's not U.S. cargo. It's not, you know, so whatever one thinks about the Trump administration's attitude toward trade in the main, it's not our trade. And that's right. The kind of perplexing thing here, that if you reduce it to the Trump administration is using the U.S. military in an ineffectual campaign to protect Europe's trade with China, your head would explode, right? The logic bot would say that doesn't compute. And yet, here we are. So it's a completely perplexing thing. And I think, you know, it's no great secret. And maybe it is a great secret. It was buried in, you know, paragraph 14 of a New York Times story over the weekend about all of this. That Benjamin Netanyahu is pressing the United States, the Trump administration, to join it in an air campaign against Iran. Benjamin Netanyahu wanting the United States to have a war with Iran is not news. It's always like saying the sun rises in the east. It's just what he's been quite clear about this, I think admirably clear. And we've not really squared up to this reality ourselves. So I think there's, you know, this a risk that elements in the administration are sympathetic to this idea. The narrative is pretty logical. It says the Iranians are making great strides forward in their nuclear program and have a higher level of higher enriched uranium at 60% than they've had heretofore. Their air defenses have been, I think this case is overstated, denuded by the Israeli campaign, the sort of back and forth that we had a few months ago. And their proxy Hezbollah has been neutered by Israeli strikes in Lebanon. Therefore, it's time to go. I think this case is unpersuasive on a lot of levels. But if you cordon off what's wrong with it, you can hear somebody in the Oval Office making the case for it. So I think the real risk here is that the unsatisfactory and ineffectual Houthi campaign plugs into a much broader campaign of war with Iran.
Yeah, I guess that points at one of the really interesting sort of contradictions of the Trump administration early on in the second term is that, you know, in the first term, you could say a lot about his decisions on advisors, but by and large, they were from the more hawkish sort of traditional GOP set. But this time around, you've actually got more of a diverse mix. You've got people that are, to some extent, more or less affiliated with restraint in important positions in the Pentagon, in important positions even at state. And so, I guess it's setting up an interesting tension where you seem to have sort of genuinely countervailing instincts within the administration itself.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are definitely forces inside the administration that do not want to have a war with Iran. And I think there are at least suggestions, I'm not privy to these people's calculations, that other elements inside the administration would be more sympathetic to a war with Iran. Again, the president is on the record. He signed an executive order restoring maximum pressure, and he looked queasy as he signed it. If you watch the signing ceremony, he said at the time, I didn't even want to sign this. I hope I don't have to use, I want a deal, right? But there are other people in the government that don't have that view. And so who Trump listens to and who prevails in these discussions remains to be seen. But I think there's a real risk here of escalation, both from Yemen and from the Israel-Gaza stuff spinning out of control. So for those of us who want to get the hell out of the Middle East, and, you know, I don't know, there are dozens of us, you know, it's a very tense time.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really stark. I mean, also the fact that, you know, there was so much, I think, genuine and deserved enthusiasm in the initial days of the Trump administration when they did succeed, when Steve Witkoff seemed to have just gone to the Middle East and read Netanyahu the Riot Act and said, you're stopping this damn war. And it's so stark to see how just a couple months in, we're starting to see, you know, now they're endorsing Israel continuing this campaign. They, you know, were warned ahead of time and didn't apparently stop them from this return into Gaza. And Trump himself seems to be particularly moved by Netanyahu's perspective on the plight of the hostages and the need to destroy Hamas completely. So it's a really unusual place that we're left now. But I guess the question that comes off of that from my perspective is how does the restraint movement, you know, this movement broadly focused on reducing the role of the military and or like active role of the military in American foreign affairs, you know, how does the movement, and particularly the conservative part of the movement, deal with this sort of schizophrenic Trump administration?
Well, I mean, I think it's to call balls and strikes, right? You know, again, the piece that you kindly mentioned in the opening led with, you know, the president's characterization of his own goals, right? And if you want to be a peacemaker, if you want to be graded on the wars that you stay out of, and if you want to deal with Iran, then maybe don't follow Benjamin Netanyahu's lead. I don't know. My colleague John Hoffman next door here, you know, had a piece that basically, you know, I think the title was "Don't," you know, "Trump shouldn't follow Netanyahu's lead." So I think, you know, where I don't know. I my place in history is small. I'm a little grain of sand on a huge beach.
Oh, you undersell yourself, Justin. I'm sure you'll move the entire administration.
Where the restraint movement goes from here? Again, I think we have to stay principled and say what's right and what's wrong. And so we'll have some opportunities here on this discussion to talk about some things I think are going really well. But the Middle East could drop, you know, I mean, it could all go to hell in the Middle East, as is the case for every U.S. administration in my career, right? There's always the ability to ruin your administration with Middle East policy. And boy, oh boy, a lot of American administrations have taken that option, perplexingly.
Yeah, no, it does. It seems like something of a trap. And especially, I mean, you look at the Trump administration, like the types of thinking. I guess maybe the idea of this is similar to the idea that had been behind, you know, the sort of consistent version of this that might still be within an America First frame is that kind of striking hard and striking fast and then pulling back is something that I think a lot of people in Trump world see as useful, right? I'm thinking of the Soleimani strike that killed, obviously, one of the most important Iranian generals back in 2020. A lot of people thought that would lead to World War III, and a lot of Trump people point and say, no, it did not, right? Mm-hmm. What it did was interfere with the ability of the Iranians to kind of interact effectively with Hezbollah, to interact effectively with Iraqi militias, and it did somewhat degrade their capabilities. And so it's this interesting thing where I guess you kind of have to wait around and see, but I don't know. It feels like a strange way to really start, because we're only 2 months into this administration.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was one of the grouchy people who pointed out that the Iranians did respond to the Soleimani strike,
right?
And we had over 100 U.S. service members that had traumatic brain injuries after the strike, which Trump later characterized as headaches. Mm. So, you know, but his ability, I mean, I think that's illustrative of his ability to elide relevant facts. And, you know, it's a gift. I don't have that gift, right? If you call me on the carpet for something, you know, the consequences of something that I did, I'll sort of look down at my shoes and take my talking to, but he just blows past consequences in that way. So I agree with you. It's perplexing. I mean, I think I can't explain it.
Yeah. Well, that's good, because my next question was going to be if you had a grand unified theory of Trump's foreign policy, but it sounds like we should skip that one. So why don't we go over to Europe, which I think will be a particularly fruitful area, because I think that you, by and large, well, why don't I just let you lay it out? How has Trump done with regard to, you know, U.S. policy toward Europe, including Ukraine, in these first 2 months?
I think great. I was of a mind that the administration was going to have to go really hard and really fast in Europe to make an impact. Presidential administration is actually quite short, and we have 80 years of accumulated commitments and institutions and what have you. So I'm not a go fast and break stuff guy by disposition, but here I think going fast and breaking stuff was going to be the right way to go. I think they've done that. I think if you look at the arc of history that began with, well, not even arc of history, it's a tiny little blip, but an awful lot has happened. That began with the Hegseth speech in Brussels, I like to call it the Uncle Sucker speech, but I have to like that. So the Vance speech, the Oval Office dust up. I mean, this is like a really short period of time. And ask yourself, what has transpired as a result of all of that? Well, the story that I would tell you is the Rearm Europe initiative, which was launched by the EU, provided 650 billion euro in relaxation of the so-called Growth and Stability Pact, which restricts member states' ability to deficit spend, right, and provides 150 billion euro of European EU monies. Oops, I'm reconnected. Of European monies for states to buy weapons. And perhaps the coup de grace here is the Germans, of all people, I'll say it again, the Germans have found 500 billion euro, give or take, in the couch cushions to spend on weapons over the next 10 years. Now, how badly will the Germans screw this up? I don't know. They'll screw it up. They're going to do a lot of things that are dumb. But even if you do spend on a lot of things that are dumb, 500 billion euro over 10 years ain't nothing. So I think this is directly a consequence of the administration's, let's call it what it is, browbeating of the Europeans that's transpired since they took office. I think it's a good thing. I think that Europe should be able to do the vast majority of the conventional deterrence itself. It has a GDP 10 times Russia's. It has a population five or six times as large as Russia's. And depending on how one counts, its existing military expenditures are two or three times Russia's. That's good enough, right? I wrote a piece with Josh Schifrinson last year called in Foreign Affairs called A Post-American Europe, where the title that we had and the kicker at the end of the article was, it's time to take the win. Right. This is as good as it's going to get. Putin's Russia is not Wilhelmine Germany, Nazi Germany, or Joe Stalin's Soviet Union. It can't dominate Europe. That's a good thing. And so American policy should take the win and tell the Europeans that they're on the hook for the vast majority of Europe's defense needs. And it looks like they're doing that, and it looks like they're meeting with some success. So there's not a lot. I mean, restrainers complain a lot about a lot of things, right, but I think there ought not to be a lot for restrainers to complain about the Trump administration's Europe policy.
Yeah, I guess I'll try some complaints just to keep things interesting. But before I get to those complaints, I guess one broader thing that I'm thinking about with all of these European promises is that it does feel like we've seen some of these promises before, right? It does feel like when obviously the invasion of Ukraine happened, you had all this talk of Germany suddenly, you know, again, we're back to Germany, reorienting its entire armed forces, having, I forget the term they use, but something
the Zeitenwende, the new era or whatever.
Yeah. Exactly. There's always a long German word to describe any good feeling, but that didn't come through, right? You know, 3 years later, and you can blame, I think, the Biden administration in part for that. But it's also got to do with the internal politics of these countries in Europe with the difficulties that they have doing this. So I guess, you know, I guess in order to achieve a more sustainable version of this, I guess you would hope that the Trump administration sort of really continues hammering away at this idea that the U.S. is not going to be at your back anymore.
Yeah. And I think I agree with your pessimism. I want to associate myself with it. However, I think that the administration has the ability to follow through. And I think there is a real possibility of U.S. troop withdrawals from Europe, which will clarify this issue even further. I mean, I think that, you know, inertia is one of the most powerful and neglected forces in social life. The reason people do things the way they do is because that's the way they've been doing them. And you have three or four generations of policymakers on both sides of the Atlantic who have been socialized and taken to understand that, you know, the way the transatlantic bargain works is we do a lot of the heavy lifting and the Europeans let us. And I think that will need regular repetitions over and over to make clear that it's not the case. The reason I'm somewhat sunnier about the developments heretofore is, number one, the Trump administration is going to be around for a while longer to drive the point home over and over. And number two, for people who don't live and breathe this stuff, it might sound weird. Well, it does sound weird because it is weird. But the big development here is the Germans getting over their allergy to debt. There is a pathology in Germany that I don't know, some people ascribe it to, you know, the sort of Weimar period. I'll leave the sort of psychotherapy aspect here to others, but they are really, really freaked out about debt. They don't like debt, and they've bitten the bullet and cobbled together a political coalition for debt, right? So the other half of this 500 billion euro, it's $1 trillion that the Germans have found in the couch cushions. And what they're going to spend it on is the other stuff is like green stuff and infrastructure stuff, which there are different constituencies for. So I think that the reason for that I'm somewhat more optimistic is not just that the, you know, Trump administration will continue delivering beatings until morale improves over there, but also that they've committed to issue debt for an array of things, not just defense, but also infrastructure and green, I don't know, German green stuff. So there are now constituencies for debt in Germany, not just on defense. So I play this back in 3 years and I will, you know, shake my head and pour, you know, put ashes on my head or whatever. But I think this time might be different.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And so what does that look like kind of concretely? Like, let's put some meat on the bones of this. So the U.S. In this case is maybe kind of pulling back troops from Europe, pulling back potentially even some more sort of the active sides of NATO, maybe focusing not quite maybe the like dormant NATO idea that Sumantra Maitra of the American Conservative has made, but something to that effect, right? Where NATO is a bit more of a traditional alliance and not this sort of active organization. And then the expectation is that Europe sort of finds a more healthy balance within itself. Like what does it look like for that balance to actually be found?
They spend a little bit more on their military and even so don't get invaded by Russia. I mean, I think the number of things that need to change, certainly from the American point of view, is not that high. But Russia isn't going to invade Spain or Italy ever. Right. It's just not going to happen. And, you know, the frontline states, you know, if you look at what Poland is doing, it's behaving an awful lot like a country that thinks that its defense is increasingly in its own hands. And I think there is a shift in particular. I wrote this memo, I don't know, a few months ago about, you know, it was sort of polemical and, you know, one of the headings was Germany is the problem, right? Mm-hmm. So we talked about the German problem 100 years ago or, you know, throughout the first half of the 20th century. And the German problem was they just could not live within their borders, right? They kept breaking out and looking for Lebensraum or what have you. And in my story, the German problem is the opposite, right? My grandfathers, rest in peace, would be spinning in their graves if they heard me say the world and Europe needs more Germany. But the world and Europe does need more Germany. And so the German problem is sort of the reverse of what it used to be. But now it looks like the world and Europe might be getting more Germany, which is the only problem that needed to be solved. And so, you know, if you view the U.S. interest in Europe as essentially counter-hegemonic, if you'll forgive me a BS IR jargon term, we don't want one country to dominate Europe. You know, I sort of said right. We didn't want Kaiser Bill to dominate Europe. We certainly didn't want Adolf Hitler to dominate Europe. And we didn't want Joe Stalin to dominate Europe either. Well, guess what? It's El Dorado, right? There's no candidate for dominating Europe unless you have really kooky views about what the EU is capable of, or really fundamentally wrong empirical views about what Vladimir Putin's Russia is capable of. A country that struggles to bully Ukraine is not a plausible threat for hegemony in Europe. End story. And we're seeing that Russia is struggling mightily to bully Ukraine. Well, right. The implication of that is that it can't dominate Europe, which it sucks for Ukraine. I'm the first one to say that, but the implication for the rest of Europe is good in the sense that we're seeing that the Russian military in offensive operations, even in a country, these operations are taking place in close proximity to the Russian border. If you right. stretch these lines of communication out 300, 400, 500 miles longer, guess what? The Russians get even less effective than they've been in Ukraine. So it's not new that countries get less effective operating, or countries' militaries get less effective the further from their borders they operate. But we're seeing it play out here again, and the implications for European security are good.
Yeah. Yeah, this is kind of half an idea, but I'm curious to get your thoughts. I'm kind of wondering how an American pullback affects the internal dynamics of Europe a little bit, because one thing that's interesting is that you have the U.S. sort of rhetorically on the side of those eastern flank countries of your like Poland's and like ex-Soviet countries that are on the very hawkish side towards Russia, that are very sort of scared of a potential Russian invasion, that want us to do very aggressive things and push things to the limit. But from a practical point of view, we've always kind of sided a little bit more with Western Europe because our interests fundamentally align a little bit more with the states that are not at actual risk. So, you know, again, this is all a little fuzzy as I'm phrasing it, but I'm curious if you see a possibility of any of those dynamics shifting. You know, does Eastern Europe become less empowered, less able to make such strident things if the US pulls back? Or I don't know. You see what I mean. It's half a thought, but I'm curious to get yours.
Well, I mean, if we win, it's going to be really bad for the Baltic states. I mean, like, let me bring it down as far as I can. You know, if you look at, and if I may, Kaja Kallas has not been doing any favors for the sort of escalation caucus within NATO.
Yeah, and she's the foreign policy head chief of the EU now, right?
Sorry. Yes, and former prime minister of Estonia. Extremely right. hawkish. She's become basically persona non grata in Washington. She was here a few weeks ago for meetings that she did not get at the State Department. Rubio basically negged her, just sort of, you know, we're not having a meeting. So she had to meet with Congress people, which sucks for an EU foreign policy chief. The juxtaposition of meetings at the State Department versus meeting with random senators and congressmen and women is not the same. But yeah, if the United States withdrew large numbers of forces from Europe, the Baltic states would be, I mean, look, let me start this over. The Baltic states, with a robust U.S. commitment to NATO or without a robust U.S. commitment to NATO, are extremely militarily vulnerable. They were admitted to NATO in 2004. The U.S. Senate debate did not discuss at all the defense requirements of the Baltic states, focusing instead on how heroically and nobly the Balts had committed themselves to the global war on terror, including the Iraq War. And it was represented that this earned them NATO membership. The vote in the Senate was 96-0 to admit countries that, if you just look at a map, are extremely vulnerable to Russian predation, without a perfunctory discussion of what the defense requirements of these countries would be. They did not have any NATO plan for their defense until 2010, when they were freaked out, understandably, by the Russian invasion of Georgia, which took place immediately after the Bucharest Declaration, where the Bush administration strong-armed other NATO members into saying that Georgia and Ukraine would one day become members of NATO. The predictable and predicted response to this was the Russian invasion of Georgia, later predation in Ukraine in 2014. But the reason, if you look at, it was actually a WikiLeaks thing that came out. The U.S. ambassador to NATO at the time, Ivo Dalder, responded to the Baltic states asking for a NATO defense plan by saying, "We don't want to provoke Russia, you see." And this is the sort of like doublethink in U.S. policy in Europe, which is that we want to do all this stuff substantively, like bringing the Baltic states into NATO, that is going to tick off the Russians, but we don't want to tick off the Russians. Well, guess what, Ivo? You're stuck, right? If you bring the Balts into NATO and a few years later say that you're going to bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO, you're going to tick off the Russians. And so that we just didn't have an honest discussion about the idea that we would kind of sort of commit to go to war with Russia over the Baltic states. We instead said, isn't it nice that they've sent some people to Iraq to help us occupy that country? And now, you know, we're stuck in a sense with the Baltic states in NATO. And if the U.S. commitment to NATO softens, that's going to be bad for the Baltic states. And I just don't think it's worth making any bones about that. But the other parts of NATO, even the hawkish parts to include Poland, you know, are doing a lot of the things that they ought to be doing to shore up their own defenses. So I, you know, the big caveat, the big, you know, I just sort of told on myself, you know, the people whose ox really get gored by my preferred policy are the Balts, right? Because they'd be left in the lurch, and they should and do violently oppose my ideas and even the Trump administration's preferred policies in Europe. Sorry, I have a million different things going on.
It's okay. Yeah, it's funny, and you notice that they're very one really stark thing about the Baltic countries that I've noticed being in media is they're actually very good at PR. You know, they really get, they'll send their foreign ministers and their prime ministers and stuff to DC. They get on the phone with every journalist. They go around Congress all the time. They're really good at pushing these interests. And like you say, it's out of a sincere sort of a sincere need. But I guess this gets at maybe the most fundamental question of what it looks like for the U.S. to be pulling back from Europe, which is that obviously, no matter what, if we're pulling back, like you're saying, that increases the threat to the Baltic states. But they remain members of NATO. They remain our treaty allies that we're in theory obligated to come and protect. So I guess, are we weakening, you know, to do the sort of hawker side of the argument, are we weakening our ability to deter Russian aggression and our sort of this idea that we are actually going to come to the aid of these countries if we do pull back?
Well, this was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.